This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI and a watch and tab on any plan. Only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan. Service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Wait. This one is Trevor. I still have other stuff to promote. Do you like ancient mythology? Do you like coffee table books? How about the periodic table? Have you ever really wanted to have my writing in print for some reason? I recently contributed to a periodic table of Greek mythology, along with over 120 other classicists, to create a cool book covering a huge range of historical and mythological characters. Even Xerxes is in there. Personally, I wrote the article on Cronus, the primordial god of time, a Greek deity who will be surprisingly important on the history of Persia. This project was organized and published by Working Classicists, an organization that promotes and supports making classical studies available to everyone regardless of their socioeconomic background, and all of the proceeds go to supporting their efforts. You can buy your own copy of A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology at contubernalesbooks.com. That's contubernales books.com, or wherever books are sold. If you Google A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology, you'll probably find it. This is a great project supporting a great cause. Go check it out. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 143, The First Syrian War. Last time, we covered King Antiochus I Soter's war with the Galatian tribes, who crossed into Asia with an invitation from Nicomedes of Bithynia and the Northern League, then proceeded to wreak havoc across western Anatolia until a small force under Antiochus managed to lure some of them into a pitched battle. Antiochus reportedly deployed his elephants to devastating effect in that confrontation and leveraged his victory to contain the Gauls to the newly created province of Galatia, mostly. Continued sporadic Galatian raids spurred urbanization in central Anatolia as a powerful Seleucid nobility raced to construct new fortified settlements that the Galatians would rather ignore. Still, the damage was done. Between the Gallic chaos and fighting rebellions on every front for almost 6 straight years, Antiochus had lost the initiative. He made peace with Antigonus Gonatas and relinquished the Seleucid claim to Thrace and Macedon. The situation in northern Anatolia wasn't much better. After spreading himself thin, Antiochus was forced to recognize the dynasts of the Northern League as independent kings and city-states, and he wasn't done just yet. I ended the last episode with Ptolemy II Philadelphus leading an Egyptian invasion of Seleucid Syria. And that is where we are headed today. So let's talk about Ptolemy. Currently, mercifully, the only royal with that name we need to worry about, since Kerenos is dead and the future Ptolemy III is only a toddler at this point. Immediately after Seleucus' death, Ptolemy seized on the chaos in Anatolia to take control of the coasts and islands of the south, from Miletus to Cilicia, and solidified his control over Coel Syria as far north as Damascus. However, it's been a while since Egypt was really a direct player in the wars of the Hellenistic kings. Mostly, they've just supported various contenders and made land grabs in the chaos for about 30 years. At home, though, the Ptolemies consolidated their rule over Egypt and Libya. When Antiochus started getting more actively hostile toward Ptolemy in 276, the king of Egypt was actually far to the south, mounting an invasion of northern Nubia and conquering all the way down to the second cataract of the Nile in modern Sudan. Ptolemy I had started a policy of public Egyptianization. Even though the royal family themselves were culturally Macedonian in every way that mattered, down to not usually even bothering to learn the Egyptian language, they carefully presented themselves in the traditional style of the pharaohs, and were happy to embrace specific customs when it suited them. Ptolemy II's southern expansion was part of a wider project to control regional trade. Unlike any Egyptian ruler for centuries past, he focused heavily on colonizing the Red Sea coast, and he put his people to work in the Sinai, reopening Darius the Great's Suez Canal, linking the Nile to the Red Sea after decades of silting shut. More importantly for our story, 274 BCE places us squarely in the middle of some Ptolemaic family drama. I am going to jump around in time here a little bit, because this first story does come later chronologically, but it is less important. I mostly bring it up because it explains Ptolemy's epithet, Philadelphus, and because it's just kind of funny. So while Ptolemy was invading Nubia, his sister returned home. Of course, Ptolemy II had many siblings and even a few step-siblings who have come up in recent episodes. This sister was Arsinoe, who left Egypt a little more than a decade earlier to marry Lysimachus. That happened to form an alliance between the Ptolemies and Lysimachus that never really amounted to much, and by pure happenstance, the daughter Lysimachus had sent to marry the young Ptolemy II was also named Arsinoe. That woman is traditionally called Queen Arsinoe I of Egypt. So Sister Arsinoe had been in Macedon when Lysimachus was killed in battle. She then married her half-brother Ptolemy Carinaus when he murdered Seleucus and took over. It was a way of establishing Carinaus's legitimacy, both as Lysimachus's successor and for his claim to the Egyptian throne. Then Carinaus was killed by the Gauls, and Arsinoe holed up in a Macedonian city while the succession crisis played out around her. When Antigonus Gonatas took over, Arsinoe fled back to her brother's court in Egypt. Then, after the Nubian War, Ptolemy II married his sister, making her Queen Arsinoe II of Egypt. I only said we didn't have to worry about multiple Ptolemies. To be clear, Arsinoe I and II are both the wives of Ptolemy II Philadelphus. Why Philadelphus? Well, if you got the same basic American history education as me, you might know that Philadelphia is supposed to mean the city of brotherly love. That is not quite accurate. Delph can refer to either end of the gender binary, depending on the grammatical ending, and people who named cities Philadelphia were usually thinking of a different sense of the word than the poets who coined Ptolemy Philadelphus. His epithet is literally sister lover. Later generations of Ptolemies would certainly marry brothers and sisters together, and as we've seen, there is a long history of West Asian and Egyptian monarchs marrying their siblings for both political and sexual reasons. So far as we can actually tell, Ptolemy Philadelphus and Arsinoe II were purely political. They had no children together, although Ptolemy did order that all of their children from previous marriages legally be declared the children of Ptolemy and Arsinoe II. It was a way to establish a dynastic claim over Macedon, and to protect Arsinoe from political fallout in Egypt. However, that was not the only Ptolemaic marriage happening in the 270s. Meet Magas, Ptolemy Philadelphus's half-brother from his mother's first marriage. Magas was only 3 when he moved to Egypt and was wholly integrated into the Ptolemaic nobility. Although as a stepson, he was not considered a legitimate heir. Instead, Ptolemy I sent Magas west to become the Egyptian governor of Cyrenaica, the Greek territory along the western coast of modern Libya. This all put Magas in an odd position. He wasn't Ptolemy I's biological son and couldn't really have expected to inherit the kingdom. But history has shown time and time again that older brothers tend to resent their younger siblings becoming king over them. It also meant that Magas had a lot of autonomy, given that Cyrenaica and Egypt were separated by hundreds of miles of Libya's more treacherous eastern coastline, and that Magas had more direct dealings with the non-Macedonian powers out there. Of course, pan-Mediterranean trade was well established at this point, but aside from Pyrrhus, Magas was the early Hellenistic leader who had the most to deal with Western powers like Rome, Carthage, and Sicily. So Magas agitated for independence from Egypt, or at least greater autonomy, when Philadelphus became king. Magas pushed the bounds of what was allowed, like refusing to pay his taxes or engaging in foreign diplomacy that may or may not benefit Egypt as a whole. For example, forming his own personal marriage alliance with Antiochus. Like the rest of Antiochus's reign, none of this is well documented, so we don't know exactly which event came first. But in 276 BC, Magas and Antiochus got in touch. Magas married Antiochus's daughter, Apame, and Magas declared himself the independent king of Cyrene. Initially, Ptolemy didn't overly worry about this. His brother's rebellion was disappointing but predictable. Then, in late 275 or very early in 274, Magas and Antiochus went to war with Egypt. The motivation for this alliance is easy enough to understand. The Seleucid dynasty had a claim to Coel Syria, as promised to Seleucus in the Treaty of Ipsus. Magas wanted to be independent, and Ptolemy was currently king of both southern Syria and Cyrenaica. So, Magas and Antiochus realized it would be pretty easy to force their common enemy into a two-front war. The thing is, it's not clear who started things in Syria. Only Pausanias mentions who started it, and he blames Antiochus. Many modern historians think this is unlikely. If Antiochus was in the middle of a war with the Gauls, he would hardly have wanted to make plans to open another conflict. He also would likely have already gathered his armies if he was planning for an invasion, but a Babylonian astronomical diary tells us that troops and elephants scrambled to go west when the war started. In all likelihood, Magus acted without Antiochus's say-so almost as soon as he got word that the Galatian conflict was over, and Ptolemy responded by attacking both of his enemies. This action wasn't just Magus crowning himself king. Like I said, Ptolemy didn't seem particularly bothered by that in 276. 2 years later, though, something prompted Magus to go on the offensive. We don't really know what. He might just have spent 2 years consolidating power and building up an army in Cyrenaica, or he could have been fighting Ptolemaic loyalists at home in that time. I would guess that, whatever was happening, it was just barely settled enough for Magus to risk leaving home, because before leaving, Magus disassembled the walls of Cyrene. These probably weren't the giant stone walls we usually picture for important ancient cities. Many poorer or less frequently threatened cities were defended by at least partially wooden stockades. These could be very elaborate, but Magus was worried about a rebellion while he was gone. So just in case, he had large sections of his own capital's walls removed to prevent potential rebels from holding the city against him. Then, Magus went west. He likely didn't have enough ships to ferry everyone to Egypt and just marched along the arid coastline with supply ships shadowing the army. Likely picking up indigenous Libyan mercenaries along the way to invade Egypt. This gave Ptolemy time to respond by hiring his own mercenaries, a force of several thousand Gauls. It is not clear where these guys came from. The poet Callimachus refers to them as Galatians, but that may just be because they were Gauls outside of Europe. They may have been hired from one of the bands still pillaging Thrace, or they could have been refugees who escaped Antiochus the previous year. It is impossible to know. These Gallic reinforcements were a miscalculation on Ptolemy's part. The Nile Delta would have been quite a culture shock for people more used to the poor inland regions of Europe and Anatolia. They suddenly found themselves in an incredibly rich and verdant place, and they opted to just pillage Egypt instead, forcing Ptolemy to abandon his northwestern border and chase after his own mercenaries. Like a shocking number of armies before them, the Gallic mercenaries made the mistake of trying to cross the Nile in stages, stopping on an island in the middle of the river, presumably in the southern Nile Delta. Ptolemy's forces surrounded them on both sides and just prevented the Gauls from leaving the island until they began to die of starvation and fight amongst themselves. But starvation takes time, which Ptolemy did not have. While the Egyptian army was distracted, the Cyrenaeans reached Egypt and assaulted the town of Paraetonium, somewhere on the western border. We don't hear much about the actual battle, but it was quick and decisive enough that the neighboring Ptolemaic garrisons didn't even know that it had happened. Magus ordered his men to relight a beacon fire in Paraetonium that was meant to tell the surrounding outposts everything is fine. This allowed Magus's army to continue west without facing any opposition until they reached a village called Ki, somewhere west of Anatolia. It's not clear what happened at Ki. Ptolemy should have viewed this as an existential threat. Strategically, moving the Egyptian capital to Alexandria in the far northwest was at least as good as having it at Memphis right in the middle. While Libyan raiders had harassed Egypt for millennia, they were the only real threat in the region, and only on the rare occasions that they were both well-organized and Egypt was in a crisis. The rest of Egypt's traditional enemies came from the south and east, and the complex web of canals and branches dotted with heavily populated cities made it very hard for an army to reach Alexandria. Whereas you could at least get to Memphis by following the main stem of the river. Yet, we don't hear anything about a battle at Key, or even Ptolemy and Magas ever facing off directly. Polyaenus just says that Magas reached the village. There may have been a small battle, or that just happened to be where Magas was when he got news that Cyrenaica was under attack. Whether Ptolemy instigated this or Magas's fear of rebellion was just very well founded, we don't know. But Pausanias tells us that the Libyan Marmaridae tribe rebelled. These were nomadic native Libyans who dominated most of eastern Libya's desert trade routes. And they had been vassalized by the Cyrenaeans for centuries. Their revolt forced Magas to abandon his eastward campaign. Presumably breathing a sigh of relief, Ptolemy dispatched his remaining mercenaries and hired pirates to raid Cyrenaica and keep Magas busy for the time being. Then the main Egyptian army turned around and crossed the Sinai to attack the Seleucid Empire before Antiochus could take advantage of the situation in the south. Wait. This one is Trevor. I still have other stuff to promote. Do you like ancient mythology? Do you like coffee table books? How about the periodic table? Have you ever really wanted to have my writing in print for some reason? I recently contributed to a periodic table of Greek mythology, along with over 120 other classicists, to create a cool book covering a huge range of historical and mythological characters. Even Xerxes is in there. Personally, I wrote the article on Cronus, the primordial god of time, a Greek deity who will be surprisingly important on the history of Persia. This project was organized and published by Working Classicists, an organization that promotes and supports making classical studies available to everyone regardless of their socioeconomic background, and all of the proceeds go to supporting their efforts. You can buy your own copy of A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology at contubernalesbooks.com. That's contubernales books.com, or wherever books are sold. If you Google A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology, you'll probably find it. This is a great project supporting a great cause. Go check it out. That this was even an option is good evidence that Antiochus and Magas were not nearly as coordinated as writers like Pausanias try to portray it after the fact. While Magas was invading, Antiochus was still barely able to get elephants from Bactria to the west, alongside a royal army that had assembled in Babylon, before heading to join Antiochus and the veterans of the Galatian War. Possibly fearing further unrest in Babylon itself, Antiochus also ordered more Babylonians to relocate to Seleucia on the Tigris. Once again, this is something that ancient and modern authors alike have interpreted as Antiochus relocating the whole Babylonian population to a new city. But it still is not the case. Babylon was a major urban center for centuries after this. Most likely, these were political hostages relocated to ensure good behavior while the army was away. Antiochus was also concerned enough about this war to appoint his teenage son, another Seleucus, as co-king. Seleucus was barely old enough to receive his first official responsibilities under normal circumstances, but after the disasters in Anatolia, Antiochus wasn't in a position to risk his own legitimacy by commanding from the rear. And, as I said, unrest in the East was still a real possibility. He needed someone with full royal authority in Babylonia, so Seleucus was now co-king. Tracking the Seleucid side of this war is roughly impossible, because most of the story has only survived in snippets of a few sentences spread across a dozen different sources from Greece, Italy, Egypt, and Babylon. It is so scattershot that some historians, including John D. Granger, whose book The Rise of the Seleucid Empire is an integral resource for anybody trying to follow a historical narrative, dismiss most of these stories entirely. I strongly disagree with that approach. Yes, ancient historians have been known to make things up and misattribute historical events, especially in cases where several people with the same name did similar things. Yes, the sources for this war are dangerously out of context, but to dismiss them in their entirety borders on equally irresponsible. Some, like the Python Steles, claim that Ptolemy went all the way to Persia, are clearly absurd. But others, like Granger's assertion that Antiochus III, rather than Antiochus I, is the real subject of Polyaenus's Battle of Damascus, are unnecessary. Damascus, as a valuable border city, would naturally have been one of Antiochus's first stops. It seems unlikely that Antiochus would just march into Syria or the Levant while Ptolemy still controlled large swaths of southern Anatolia. And the relevant astronomical diary in Babylon supports this, indicating that the royal army met Antiochus at Sardis, likely for an attack on the Ptolemaic holdings in Anatolia. This is likely the context for a story Stephanus of Byzantium attributed to the Cilician priest historian Apollonius. I say likely because it is also sometimes interpreted as some sort of war between the kingdom of Pontus and Egypt, which makes very little sense given their relative locations, and Apollonius wrote a history of Cilicia, which wouldn't involve Pontus very often at all. But that is a very frequent interpretation of this passage anyway. At some point during this war with Ptolemy, Antiochus hired Galatians as mercenaries to participate in the reconquest of Caria. These Galatians fought so effectively that they independently wiped out a Ptolemaic invasion force, pursuing the Egyptians to their ships, boarding them before they could escape, and taking the ship's anchors as trophies. The word anchor, by the way, likely descends from the Greek word ankoura, and as payment for going above and beyond in battle, Antiochus sponsored the construction of a new city for the Galatian settlers, which they named Ancura in honor of this battle. If a city called Ancura in the middle of modern Turkey rings any bells, it should. This is where the modern Turkish capital, Ankara, got its start. That said, it's also suspiciously close to a much older settlement called Ankuwash, which may have had something to do with the name choice. Either after retaking most of Ptolemaic Anatolia, or while it was going on under his subordinates, Antiochus marched south to finally make good on the Seleucid claims to Coel Syria, starting with Damascus. The Ptolemaic general Dion had heavily fortified the city after taking control at the start of Antiochus's reign, and rather than besieging it, Antiochus threw a giant party for his army. Apparently, they arrived in the region during an important Persian festival. We don't know when this happened, aside from early in the First Syrian War, and therefore we don't know what holiday this was. Nowruz or Maragon would make sense, since we know those were important, but any of the Persian cultural or religious festivals are possible. Regardless, Antiochus spared no expense, and he even ordered his noble officers to do the same. Hearing that the Seleucid army was so preoccupied, Dion told his men to relax for a few days, which is exactly what Antiochus wanted. Rather than hauling all of his siege engines and supplies along the road, Antiochus had everyone pack just enough flour to eat for 4 days, and marched his troops straight through the desert to avoid any lingering Ptolemaic scouts. The Seleucid army suddenly appeared outside of Damascus from a direction that nobody was watching, and assaulted a city that had let its guard down, taking the old Syrian capital in a quick and bloody attack. The Seleucid advance into Syria was concerning enough that Ptolemy actually relocated his core advisors and family, including Arsinoe II, to Pelusium, in order to run the preparations for an invasion of Egypt, meaning there was genuine concern that all of Phoenicia and Palestine might fall to the Seleucids early on. With the stories I've told so far, you might be expecting this to be Antiochus's moment of triumph, sweeping through Coel Syria and finally capturing all of that territory his father had won on paper in the Battle of Ipsus. But all of this, taking Damascus, the Galatian victory in Caria, and Ptolemy preparing the defenses at Pelusium, happened around 274 and 273. The war lasted until 271 or 270, and our surviving sources say nothing of the battles fought in that time. When information resurfaces in 270, the war was over. The borders in Anatolia and Syria alike barely changed at all. Caria largely went to Antiochus, but major cities like Miletus remained loyal to Ptolemy, and a treaty had been signed. Ptolemy hosted a giant festival in Alexandria. The war was over, and Egypt had won decisively. How? We have absolutely no idea. Ptolemaic naval supremacy certainly played a part. The Seleucid navy barely existed in the Mediterranean, whereas Ptolemy controlled the most powerful fleet in the sea. But with an ending like that, it's not surprising that this went down in history as the First Syrian War. Oddly enough, things were more successful on the Cyrenaean front. Magus defeated his rebels and drove out his brother's mercenaries. He even sealed the deal by forming a marriage pact with Ptolemy, meaning Cyrenaica was formally recognized as independent when Magus's daughter Berenike was betrothed to the young Ptolemy III. He went on to be a major sponsor of artists and philosophers in his kingdom, but Cyrenaican independence did mean that the western city-states that used to deal with Magus as a proxy for Egypt now had to go a little further and meet with Ptolemy himself. This eventually led a pair of Roman ambassadors to arrive in Alexandria and sign the increasingly powerful city-state's first treaty with Egypt. But I'm sure nothing will come of that. Next time, Antiochus will return to his own territory and the ever-present headaches of Anatolia. Until then. If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Your old or broken phone can let you down, but at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence with a new line on My Plan and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. After all, you don't want your old phone to die on you when you're lost.
Perfect.
Or for your broken phone to glitch at the worst possible time.
Hey, can I get your number? Oh.
Trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad.
Wait, wait, wait. This one is Trevor. I still have other stuff to promote. Do you like ancient mythology? Do you like coffee table books? How about the periodic table? Have you ever really wanted to have my writing in print for some reason? I recently contributed to a periodic table of Greek mythology, along with over 120 other classicists, to create a cool book covering a huge range of historical and mythological characters. Even Xerxes is in there. Personally, I wrote the article on Cronus, the primordial god of time, a Greek deity who will be surprisingly important on the history of Persia. This project was organized and published by Working Classicists, an organization that promotes and supports making classical studies available to everyone regardless of their socioeconomic background, and all of the proceeds go to supporting their efforts. You can buy your own copy of A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology at contubernalesbooks.com. That's contubernales books.com. Or wherever books are sold. If you Google A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology, you'll probably find it. This is a great project supporting a great cause. Go check it out.